2000 AD, 40 years of Thrill Power Festival, building worlds. Borak Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to a supplemental episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast. At the beginning of February, we had a fantastically successful 40th anniversary event, and it was an incredible day. Over 1,000 Squatstick Thargo, over 100 creators, all crammed into the Novotel in Hammersmith in London for a day of panels and signings and sketchings and just general fun. And all the feedback we've had has been absolutely wonderful. So thank you to everybody who came. Now, we appreciate that not everybody could get tickets, so we thought we would bring the event to you. So in between episodes of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, we're going to be bringing you panels recorded at the 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. And we're kicking off with Building Worlds with Rob Williams, Ian Edgington, Disraeli and Ian Culbard. Now, 2000 AD has been generating new characters and series for 40 years, and two of our most prolific and popular writers, Rob Williams and Ian Edgington, are joined by their regular collaborators, Disraeli and Ian Culbard, to talk about what it takes to build new worlds and new civilizations for 2000 AD, and how these evolve and change over time. Your host for the Building Worlds panel is Mike Romeo.
I guess we'll start at the far end. We've got Ian Edgington.
Hello.
Disraeli.
Hola.
Ian Culbard.
Hello.
And Rob Williams.
Hello.
So between you guys, a lot of intermingled work, a lot of back and forth. And so I guess just to start, I'm sorry if I wasn't holding the mic well. I just want to start, I guess, start big to small. Start with the idea of the macro versus the micro. So if we're building worlds and we're populating scenes and we're creating cityscapes and things like that, where does the thinking start for each of you? Do you kind of say, oh, this is a cool general idea to put characters in, or do you start with the characters and build the world around them?
I tend to start with the big picture, and then I kind of infill it. It's like, you know, okay, what characters would be in there? What would be society, science, and things like that? And the same with Brass Sun. It's like, okay, we have a clockwork solar system. What does that entail? How would people live? You know, how would society be structured? And then I kind of work from the big down to the small, and then that's when the characters kind of come in. Well, okay, that character lives on that world, and it's influenced by these conditions and things, and that's kind of how the story kind of generates.
Rob? Are we going one after the
other?
Go on.
Well, no, it can go either way. It can either start with the world and the general concept, or it can just start with a character, or, I mean, you either build up or build down. There's no kind of like one set pattern way of doing it. I mean, the nice thing is when we've done stuff in, like doing things like Low Life, which Matt and I have done in Dredd's world, the world is, they've done the work for you in a lot of a way, because the world is there, you know, and it can be anything you want. But when I've done things in the past, which is my own like 10 seconders or whatever, I think it's more from a conceptual point of view, and then that leads you into other areas. I'm not one of these people who maps out the entire world building in that. I probably shouldn't be on this panel then. I'm a bad choice to be on this panel. But yeah, I mean, it's just, at the end of the day, it's all about the story, and it's all about the characters, and it's all about their journey and their arc through the world, rather than the world defining them. But then it kind of works both ways as you go.
How about in terms of art? Because I think of stuff like Low Life, or I think of Brass Sun, really distinctive settings, really distinctive worlds.
Well, there's two situations you can find yourself in. I mean, as Rob said, with Megacity One, you're going into an existing environment that's already been established. And I was very lucky starting on Low Life because I'd been a childhood Judge Dredd reader. So I got into 2000 AD, I think the year after it started. And I got all the big stuff in Judge Dredd where there's kind of like this period about 2 years into Judge Dredd that goes on for about another 5 years, where they're really kind of establishing the bulk of the stuff that's in the city and what it's like. You know, the fact that you've got the city blocks, the various types of citizens, the way that the world works. And so I was kind of kind of embedded in that fairly well and could just kind of take bits out. It was kind of like having a big shelf full of components. And you could just go, okay, you know, we've got an industrial zone, so you're going to need a few factories there, a few overhead walkways there, a bit of graffiti here. One of the things I quite like doing is getting types of character who were mentioned in early Judge Dredd. So, for example, in low-life street scenes, you'll often see these guys called who are called blobs, who are these guys who deliberately like removed all traces of their identity, but now they're all like old. And they and so like the prosthetics are breaking down, and they're all kind of fat and flabby, and half of them have given up on the kind of individual the kind of clothing they were wearing because they're just senile and everything. So these kind of dropping in things like that, and I don't do it as much as I used to. I really like putting statues of Fergie, the king of the Big Smelly, and it was the guy who saved the city from Judge Cal, and there were supposed to be statues of him everywhere, so I try and put those in. If you build him from scratch, I think, again, as Ian said, big to small is quite a useful thing. I mean, at the moment, I'm drawing a lot of Venusian cities for Scarlet Tracers, so you've got this kind of science fiction Venus, which is habitable, but it's still very hot, and it's a kind of desert-type culture, so when I'm drawing street scenes and things, it's like, okay, you know, what do sort of, you know, North African Moroccan type cities look like? What from that can I reference? Would they have open wells if it was a dry low water society? What other kind of things would come in? I mean, there's a scene I'm drawing at the moment that's set right on dusk going into night. Or rather, it's a scene, and I've set it there because the lighting will look good. And halfway through, there's like a street full of people. And I thought, oh, have I actually, you know, played a blinder like at a time? And thought, no. If it's a really hot environment, people will come out early in the evening like they do in, you know, African and Mediterranean countries. So actually it makes sense that you would still have bustling street markets at dusk in a way that it doesn't in a northern country. So there's all that kind of thing that you kind of have to think about. And occasionally, I'm trying to think of a specific example, but I do know in the past, I've kind of got partway into a scene and suddenly thought, oh shit, I've drawn such a thing in there and they wouldn't actually have that because of some condition in the world, and I've had to take stuff out again. So I've been caught like that too.
I've worked with, we all work with different writers. They've all got different approaches, but I'd say it starts pretty high concept and you kind of just build it in there. We had a lot of things like, and your approaches can be different. So like working with Dan, it's a very kind of hard SF-ish kind of world, sort of cyberpunky SF world. Whereas working with Ian on Brass Sun, it's a very kind of fantasy science fiction. But with Ian's stuff, with the Brass Sun stuff, I've got an Indiana Jones principle of make it up as you go along. Okay. So I just don't plan anything. Nothing's designed. It's literally, you see the very first draft of everything. Because a lot of the scripts are very spontaneous and they're very kind of like, there's tons of, it goes off on imaginative flights of fancy. So I basically don't prep anything. I just draw straight in. And then, and it builds the world as it goes along. So it's kind of like, it's cumulative. So the orrery becomes a structure that's permanent, and they become almost like a relic to the whole design feature of it. And then with Brink, it's a very hard SF kind of location, so I tend to find that you're permanently stuck with something. So a ship designer is going to, in a similar sort of sense, but it hasn't got, and I quite the same sort of make it up as you go along to it, and to that degree. So I tend to over-design on that one and until I'm super happy with it. Because with his one, I know the planet's probably going to get destroyed, so I don't have to look at it again. Whereas with the other one, I've got to look at it for a long time.
Yeah. There was one point when we were writing Blash Sun, and I was really ill. I had gastric flu and viruses, and I was medicated through the eyeballs. And I just don't remember writing it. And he just went, get drugged up and write more weird shit.
take way more Benylin. Because Yeah, because it's really, he started coming out with a whole warehouse full of cufflinks and stuff like that, which, you know, you're not going to see that room again, so I'm just going to make it up from scratch and you'll never see it again. And then, but with Brink, it's much harder because you're kind of locking everything down as you go along. But the design process as well is the other factor. What you draw often goes into the writing. So the very first episode of Brink had ambigrav. And originally in the script, it was a lockdown scene, so the body was lying on the floor, there was no gravity, and I just wrote back and said, wouldn't it be really cool if the blood was like in gravity and it was blobs and stuff? And we created ambigrav, and it became a plot point later on in the series, you see. So you kind of, if you're working collaboratively like that, design-wise, it kind of pays off. So
that's an interesting place to go from there. When you're working on these ideas, whether through the writing or through art, what is it like when they have sort of first contact with the other half of the creative process? Are there any ideas that you put out there and then the other is like, well, no, or do they grow? Do they shrink?
This, I would say, is one little thing. Working relationship-wise, when you're working collaboratively on something, it always pays to have the concept of having a third possibility. So when you don't agree on something, and the other person doesn't agree on something, that means there's a third option that neither of you have come up with. And that tends to be a more creative, and, you know, I find that, but I don't know.
There's not a lot of sort of butting heads, though, is there, really?
Not really.
When we work on Doctor Who it's kind of, it's always, as far as I'm aware, quite sort of like, there's a simpatico kind of nature to it. I think I feel one thing I like about working with both you guys is you feel like you're coming from the same place. You know what I mean? In terms of storytelling, you know.
Whereas we get the script and we go, who the hell does he think he is?
Bastard. Well, I was saying the other day, but just like, as much as we want to sort of foster this kind of air of cooperation between comics, the sad truth is that at every stage of a process, everyone is cursing the other people when they get the, you know, when the artist gets the script,
just because
he wants what? And when the inker, you know, the artist cursing the inker and et cetera. Yeah.
So are you thinking specific? Like, when I hear that, I think of that first overhead shot in Ordinary, where that room is just populated with so many things. Was that a cursing moment?
Actually, something like that isn't too bad because that's just detail, and I actually quite like drawing detail. So that's not so much of a problem. The things that make you curse are not obvious when you see the page. Like one thing that's a real pain is if you've got to do small scale stuff and big scale stuff together. Nothing written by anybody here, but the first comic script I ever worked from, which was just written by a mate of mine who wanted to be a comics writer, and I did it when I was about, I don't know, I'd be in college, so I'd have been about 18 years old. It had this one panel in it where it's a mystery, and a key clue in it was a CD, but there's this one panel in it where somebody holds up the CD and you see the label, but you also see somebody else behind them looking at it, and you also see something else out through the window behind them, which is something that an experienced writer would know not to do. But occasionally you can still actually have things which when you write them seem perfectly sensible, and then when you actually have to draw them, you suddenly realize, ooh, actually that's two actions. There are rare occasions when I've actually split panels to make things clearer. I think there's a bit in, the last one I can remember is actually in A Stickleback. There's a scene where they're in a warehouse and there's a guy with a demolition robot kind of pounding the warehouse to bits. And I can't remember what they do. They do something to kill him and knock the robot over, and he falls in the river and drowns. And I actually split a panel at the point where the thing falls into the river, and then you see him drowning because it was originally one thing. And they just—it seems when you read it, it seemed perfectly sensible. And then when you actually tried to draw it, it was like, no. But generally speaking, stuff that's just like huge accumulations of detail is that kind of, you curse because it's like, oh shit, am I going to get this in the deadline? But that's actually good. There's what I call oh shit pages, where I know that those are the ones that people are going to be talking about you know, if I do a good job on that, so everybody's going to be talking about it. I think there's maybe like one or two in the current series of Scarlet Traces, the one that I'm working on now, where I just looked and thought, oh, Christ, am I going to get that in the deadline? But I also know it's going to be like one of the things that people really remember from that series is that kind of big image. So that's not really a problem.
I think the nice thing is when the work, the writer-artist dynamic blurs sometimes. Like with Ordinary, there was so much of Ordinary was a fact because the concept was everyone in the world was affected by a plague that gave them an individual superpower, which was specific to their character. So while the main narrative is going on, the background stuff, like which is all Matt, was just like every character in the background has got an individual superpower thing going on. And not traditional. And that was so much of the richness of the book there, you know what I mean? And then also, I think, didn't you suggest one of my favorite things in it was the guy whose superpower was he could make beer appear from King of Beer,
yeah.
I think. You sent me a sketch or something with a guy going King of Beer, and it's just, that was like one of my favorite scenes in it, this guy, all these scientists trying to find out what his superpower is, and then beer keeps appearing in their hands. And no one can work it out. And then the final panel, it cuts to a wide shot, and everyone in the laboratory have all got beers.
Yeah. But I mean, that was something where I felt incredibly trusted, because there was this kind of oh shit element to okay, Matt, we can see down the street and everybody in the street's got more superpowers. Yeah. But there is also this sense of hell, you know, that's actually a lot of the kind of comic being just signed off to you. And there are kind of running jokes in Ordinary. Like one of the things I realized very quickly is you wanted to have some kind of really odd superpowers. But the other thing you could do that was great was just to put really kind of well-known superpowers into, if you put them into really ordinary looking people, it looks bizarre. So one of the running gags was what I call the Fat Flash, which was this really fat lady who moved at super speed. And because she moved at super speed, she was crossing the entire city two or three times a minute. So it meant that wherever the guy went, sooner or later in the background, you'd see the Fat Flash streaking past in the background. Have a look at Ordinary, and she reappears and reappears.
So with stuff like that, when you're working in these big worlds and everything is fresh, how are you realistic about it? At what point do you say, that's a good idea, but it doesn't make it, I don't have the space, it would be too packed?
Just change it. And then you send it back. And you say nothing. Shh.
I don't know. I mean,
anyone else?
The whispered truths.
I'm kind of the opposite in that I basically, I'm kind of like the, in terms of like world building, I'm like the that guy at a party who doesn't know when enough is enough. So I just keep going. If there's actually a point where you actually can't see what you're looking at in the panel because there's too much stuff, I'll kind of realize that I've gone overboard. But if you're doing stuff in color, you can just color the background differently and pop the figures forward. So there's, it's usually with me pretty much just a case of stamina. It's like at the point where I'm too tired to keep going, that's the point where I'll stop. But
you know that Hondo City splash in the deal.
Yeah, I mean, I just love doing stuff like that. I mean, ideally, what I'd really like to do is draw a comic with no characters in it at all, where it was all just background. And I didn't have to. It's actually those pesky guys in the foreground having to emote and do things that pisses me off. The stuff in the backgrounds, I just draw all day.
In Stickleback, it got kind of crazy because it's like one-upmanship. I thought, right. And so in one episode, we have all the kinds of Triffids that have ever appeared. And then there's all the insect races from Doctor Who. There's all the Zabi. And then there's all the different time machines from the different films as well. And they're just in the background. There's no reference to them at all. They're just part of the Brotherhood of the Book collection. And I put all links in as well to where you can find the visuals. And so we'll just slot them all in.
And actually, the plant monsters is a is a prime example of where I have no off switch, because you did about 12 and I'm sitting there drawing them and I'm thinking, I know more than this. And I'm like looking up old episodes of Star Trek, the fucking animated series on YouTube, to find that plant monster I remember from that one episode I saw when I was 7, you know.
How are we on time? Good, I'm gonna assume. No one's stopping me.
10:50.
So let's talk a little bit about building worlds in terms of 2000 AD versus, my notes say 2000 AD versus the world, but I guess versus other publishers, other places that you all have worked. Is there sort of a difference in the mindset or the approach that you take, or?
No.
Nay.
Let's kill that one.
No.
I think if you're pitching something to an American publisher and they'll say, well, we want this in 4 issues or 6 issues. But with 2000 AD, you kind of have the leisure of knowing you could maybe get 1 or 2 series, maybe a bit more. So you can have a bit more shoulder room with the storytelling and with the visuals. So you can build over a longer period of time than you would do with an American series.
You get there's a great confidence and just... I've been working for DC quite a lot the last year, and the whole thing of a shared universe is can be a joy and also can be a colossal pain in the ass, because continually things happening elsewhere are affecting your story. So when we write something for 2000 AD, you know, you're left alone, really. Do you know what I mean? I mean, and even if you do something in Dreadworld and you speak to sort of Matt Smith, and Matt will occasionally, it's very rare, but will kind of go, oh, there's a plan, which means you can't do that. It doesn't happen often. That happens pretty much weekly when you're working for the American publishers. So you can just tell the story you want to tell. Whereas very often working for the American publishers, you're constantly, I've described it, it's a bit like the floor is moving underneath you and you're trying to get across a room, you know? You just kind of go, you're trying to get to that door, and you go, you know how to get to that door, I can do that. And then they keep moving the floor sideways and keep on going. So it's a lot freer, I think, working for creating your own, you know, worlds and stories in 2080.
And that sort of freedom ends in larger worlds for you guys, I'm assuming.
It depends on the story, whether it warrants it. I mean, if it's something like Brass Sun or something where you've got, you know, I presume infinite stories you can tell in that kind of setting, you know, but... Yeah.
When Matt and I did two issues of Batman years ago, the No Man's Land thing, and you're saying about that somebody's changes has repercussions. I actually had Batman break Penguin's nose, and so for the rest of that thing, he had to talk like he had a really bad cold. So everybody else had to write Penguin D's and D's, and he had to have that big bandage on his nose, and we did that.
There's actually that same thing. It's like once in my life I got to draw Batman. And in those two episodes, there's only one time Alfred the Butler turns up. And it's like okay, I get to draw him in the background once. I finally get to draw Alfred the Butler. And then the word comes down that something in one of the other continuities affected it. And I had to airbrush Alfred the Butler out of history. So I had to patch over it. So you see that piece of artwork and you like put it under a light box. And suddenly you realize there's like a little paper patch. And Alfred shines up in one of the corners.
You should have replaced it with the Fat Flash.
Yeah, that edition.
I'd say there's more opportunities for vandalism, isn't there, in DC? I mean, if you break in Penguin's nose and everybody has to write like that, that's brilliant. That's massively affecting on...
But you're told you can't do it for that
but
reason.
But then you do it.
And you send it back.
Ian's scary whisper has been intoned. Later on in the day, that's going to turn into, get rid of him.
No.
Oh, God.
So for each of you, is this sort of storytelling a conscious effort? Does it come out, do you have to work towards it? Like, I want to do big stories, I want to do big worlds, or is it just, you can't help it?
I think for me, it kind of comes from inclination, but it is a lot of work. To be honest, there's this kind of circular thing where the way that I tell stories comes in a lot of ways from reading so much 2000 AD when I was a child, and that's fed back into the. So one of the reasons I think I'm a good fit for 2000 AD is because I grew up reading 2000 AD. But also that gave me a taste for other kind of storytelling. I mean, there's a guy called Jeff Darrow who does these fantastically detailed comics, and like not so much I think with his more recent stuff, but his earlier stuff. He did quite a bit of stuff for the European market before he kind of came to the States. And in that, actually, you read those comics for the backgrounds. They're just like city scenes full of crowded streets behind the main characters. But the thing is that every character in those crowds is differentiated, and in the next panel, all those guys have moved on a bit, and you can actually follow what's happening to them, and that kind of left an impression. So there's always kind of a bit of that in the way that I work, although for a weekly schedule, there's no way you can really do that sort of thing particularly. But I think there's a sort of a chunk of that left, but there's also to actually do it, to actually generate it yourself, you not only need the inclination, but you actually need to build a kind of stamina to kind of keep drawing when the drawing would normally look finished. It's so I do sometimes wonder actually with my stuff if I would have been better off thinking harder about the actual drawing and less about putting so much stuff into every panel. I think I might be earning a lot more money at DC or Marvel by now if I'd done that. But I'm not sure I would have been as happy. So you know,
When I was doing Brink on the first run, I think I was like 3 episodes into it, and I went back and redrew the entire thing from scratch, even though I'd done, handed in, everything was okay. But I went into hospital at one point, had an operation, lots of post-operative medication. Just suddenly woke up one day and went, oh, it's got to look like this, and went back to work and redid the whole thing from scratch. Well, basically, kind of over the top of everything I'd done. So all the positioning, like, you know, that's another thing that changes as well, is like your composition.
Yeah.
Actually dictates a lot that's in the script, what we were saying earlier about what does change. That definitely changes script to some degree because of staging, because that's not something, the idea of, you know. But anyway, back onto the other thing. Totally from scratch, starting from the beginning to the end. So the look of it, luckily, I was able to do that because of the lead-in time to it being printed.
Plus, it only takes you like 2 hours to draw a page, you bastard.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. I'm slower than you. It's just I work way, way, way longer and then condensed time using physics.
It's like, you know, we both live in Nottingham. Occasionally we'll meet up and he goes, oh, I'm slowing down now. I'm only getting like 3 pages
a day. No, it's not true. Don't listen.
That's a lie.
Yes, but it's funny.
Ian? Conscious effort.
Sometimes it's just something like a rat, and it's the idea that will pop into your head about what would life on a clockwork solar system be like, or Kingmaker, you know. It's more spontaneity, I find. Is this working? Yeah, yes. Okay, thank you. Yeah, so it's you'll get the kind of the lightning flash of the idea, and then you kind of build up around it. Or sometimes you'll get something and go, actually, no, that's rubbish, that's not going to work. But you just put it in the drawer and you'll work on something else and go, oh, actually, that will come out, and you'll recycle those characters or that bit of that plot from something you couldn't use. And then that's when it has a use kind of thing. So.
I think as long as I've been doing this, and I still don't know how stories come about. There's no process. You can't just go, this is how I do it. They sometimes you have to engineer it. And really, it's like putting a Lego set together. And other times, you do kind of just have a little flash. But in my experience, that's really rare, that eureka thing of just that. That's like once in a blue moon. But it's like oh, thank God if it does come. But it doesn't happen very often. So, but then I think it's like you don't kind of go. Oh, sometimes it is as conscious as you going, I want to do a big sci-fi thing. You know, something as broad as that, and then you engineer it within that. But yeah, it can be anything, you know. I mean, I went to see a film this week, and just the fashions in the film made me go, I really want to do a story about that. And then now I've got a story idea. So it just, anything can prompt it.
There's another one where you get the writer ask the artist, what do you want to draw? And then you sort of, the way I see it is you kind of set out your parameters. So you just jumpers for goalposts, we call it. And it's like just saying, right, we're going to play with this set of rules. And that's it. And it's like we were saying, it'd be a very beginning, high concept. I don't know, Godzilla meets The Simpsons and going from there, which is really rubbish. Don't ever do that. But there's it kind of is that simple. And then you kind of build in the factors of how would that work. And you can get really obsessive about it. We did it on when Dan and I first started working together. It was on New Deadwardians for Vertigo. And the world of that. There was a 3 or 4 hour telephone conversation when we talked about the biology of the vampires that we were making up for this thing that weren't vampires, you know, and the zombies. And we were talking about the actual biology of it, the fact that there'd be no bodily fluid going through these people, what that meant in terms of society, if you couldn't cry and you couldn't, you know, all these sorts of things. So all these things come from what if, what if, what if, what if. When you go down a trail of complete madness and eventually come back and write a script.
Are parameters important for you guys as well? Do you set parameters? Like for something like Brass Sun, are there borders and rules to it, or do you make it up as you go?
We just wing it. That's winging it. Because it works in that way. That's like improv, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, so a story will start. I'll have the bones of the story. But as I'm writing it, and then as Ian's drawing it, and he'll put something in it, go, I really like the look of that. So, and then it'll go off on a tangent. So it may well end differently from the way the outline was. You'll still be in the same place. You'll still get to the plot point you need to at the end of it. But how you got there will have been different because something he may have drawn may have fired off an idea. And I mean, in Kingmaker, Lee said, can we have dragons versus spaceships? And I go, well, it's not in the story, but it is now. And he's got dragons versus spaceships. So,
yeah.
I mean, we're all sort of big kids because you can be as sophisticated and go, well, it's all, for me, I write, it's about the theme and the arc and everything. And sometimes someone will go, do you want to do dragons versus spaceships? And you go, yes, I want to do dragons versus spaceships.
Do we have any questions from the audience? Yeah, you.
There was a library in Brass Sun that was you sent me a picture. Philadelphia Public Library, and so little things like that, you'll sometimes get some visual reference come through.
That's what takes a lot of the time. Sometimes is I'll do the script and then I'll go through Google and look Google images for something that's close to what I'm after. Yeah. And go, it's a bit like this, or I might go, it's not exactly like this, but it's the mood, it's the theme. What's that bit of clip from the film? And so,
and you use that as a springboard. So you go, okay, the basic idea is this, and then you design the hell out of it. Usually, moving very far away from it or making an exaggerated version of it. In Brass Sun, it's often just an exaggerated version of that. But it doesn't come up often because in visual reference, because the text is usually far out enough as it is, so you don't really have to. And also, you get casting suggestions as well within it, just to kind of just suggest, oh, the person kind of looks like this, for shorthand. And then you draw them and they look nothing like the person that just cast.
With Stickleback, I mean, we tend there really to mostly kind of reference real landmarks and things like that. There's certainly, I know one thing we've done is Ian sent me a whole load of stuff for kind of proposed landmarks that people had wanted to build in London and never had. So we actually added all those. So there's like a giant Statue of Britannia.
Yeah,
I think, was it Newton's tomb or something? It's like this enormous pyramid with a sphere on top.
And there were plans because there were so many dead in London, not enough place to put them. They were going to build a huge above ground mausoleum with hundreds of thousands of bodies. And of course, they decided not to do that. Yeah. But there's a couple of books, London as it would have been and London as it might have. Yeah. And so they're great for reference.
The Brompton Cemetery, that one. Yeah. No, it's the necropolis, isn't it?
Yeah. But Scarlet Traces has been rather different because in that we're tending to reference pop culture stuff. So that with that, it'll be more like, this particular setting is like something from, I don't know, UFO or Space 1999 or something. So then you look it up and then you change it just enough so you're not going to get the shit sued out of you.
Scarlet Traces is interesting because it's becoming more of an alternate future because we did War of the Worlds adaptation and then what the world was like a few years afterwards, then a few years afterwards. So we kind of, it's the reverberations of that event. So there's no Second or First World War. So that was the primary war event. And so we're in that world's 1960s now, but what does it look like when there's no World War II, but the War of the Worlds shaped the world then? So it's you're looking through it kind of like a bit of a distorted lens. So it's our world, but not quite. And it's what would be the repercussions of that event back then. You know, so how do we still feel the effects of World War II now? And so it's like how the effects of the Martian invasion affect them in the 60s. And so it's, and then the next series, it will be even more abstract because it'll be like the 80s or 90s. And so you just carry on. It's like the ripples going out now and out.
No?
No.
Okay. Anyone else?
No.
Thank you.
Thanks very much. You talked about reference material and all that kind of stuff. And they say there's no such thing as a new idea. It's only the collision between an old memory and a new memory. And there's different ways to allow your old memories and your new memories to freely associate, one of which is to do drugs, the other one is to dream. But there are things that writers and artistic people do to prompt that free association of ideas to overcome writer's block, for example, like going for a walk, having a shower, having a bath. I'd be interested to know what those techniques are.
I bang my head on the desk regularly. I used to go for walks a lot and go to the gym and swim quite a lot, but now I have two small children, so that's out the window. It is, but primarily just getting some fresh air and getting the blood pumping and going for walks, that tends to help. Otherwise, you just have to have the page in front of you and just hammer it out in the end, I find. It's until blood comes out of your ears.
Keep drawing Triffids until the story presents itself, yeah.
Just weeping for long periods and rending of clothing is good as well. It's a boring writer's thing, but I mean, I've got little checkpoints, one of which is theme, basically. And usually when I'm struggling, it's because I've gone off and I've started sort of just writing without having the theme locked down for me. I have to know what the theme is, because the theme then prompts you, because the end, it's like if you don't know what the ending is, the ending either proves the theme correct or disproves the theme, you know? So I have spinal things which stop me, hopefully stop me, you know, running down the street screaming and hugging strangers on a daily basis.
Speaking of running through the street screaming, do you ever work yourselves into a corner having all this space? Yeah.
That's a good place to be, though. Yeah. Creatively, you want to get in corners all the time, I'd imagine. Because the whole way out, you have to MacGyver your way out of the situation, and that's where the inspiration comes in, because you basically... And when you do, that's a high, basically. Okay. You go around punching the air, thinking how clever you are, and then realizing it probably doesn't matter to anybody but you. But you just sort of go, I can't believe I just came out of that corner. If anybody, everybody would champion me when I do it, but they don't.
Well, that's the thing, but it was sort of the evil nature of writing. I mean, like a show like Breaking Bad, where you knew, you could feel the writer's room would go, right, we're going to put these guys in this appalling situation. And then you just could feel like, right, how do we get them out of it? And that's the challenge. I mean, but there were certain stories, you know, that lends itself to that, and certain ones that don't. But yeah, it's that's part of the trick.
The story's basically about conflict, so... You want to create conflict, kick them in a pit and take the ladder away.
But what you do is you cheat as well, because you, when you get stuck, you go, I have no idea how to get them out of this. And then you go back and you go back to the first act and you put something in the first act which allows them to have the trap door to get them out. That makes you look much more intelligent than you actually are as a writer, when actually all it is a really obvious writer's cheat.
That's exactly. I was stuck on the story at the start. I think I know where it's going to go, so I did that Shane Black thing of starting with our hero in the middle of a fight, getting the crap kicked out of him, and then goes, but 2 days before, and then he's walking, and then you start the story. But it kind of, you know, you had to have that fight, but you can't think of the proper beginning to it. So put the fight there, and then go back to, you know, a bit Pulp Fiction-y. But it kind of, right, just putting things down on paper and the process of actually just moving. If you stop and think and you kind of seize up, but just put it, even if you're going to throw that stuff away, you just got to keep on moving and moving and moving. And then something eventually unclogs, and then you go, oh, okay, you know, the drain unclogs and you hear it gurgle and you're off, kind of thing.
So the lesson is, if you're trapped in a burning building, don't look to a writer to get you out.
No, this is good for conflict.
Exactly.
Yeah, we'd write a good monologue for when you burned to death. You know, that's a nice.
These are your last
words. That's a nice emotional beat. Oh, you were supposed to save us. Oh shit! Sorry.
Yeah. Any others? Hi, and then you afterwards. I see you.
Have you ever had a situation where you've had an idea for a series, and today's an AD, it's an anthology. Really, the whole world is open to you, but it was science fictional, it was a good idea, but 2000 AD, it didn't fit. What kind of things don't fit in 2000 AD?
I've actually done that. I developed an idea with a guy called Nigel Kitching, who did a series called Ahab for 2000, about 10 years ago now. And I'd known him for years. Nigel actually, like, at one point was writing and drawing most of Sonic the Comic for years. He's mostly known for, like, more cartoony stuff, but he did this thing for 2000. It was like, oh, I've cracked 2000. Let's put something together. And so we put this series together, and it was pretty much, we thought, assembled from, like, classic 2000 AD elements, and we sent it into Matt Smith, and he just went, no. And it just happens. I think the big lesson that I've learned about comics, particularly from knowing lots of writers, because it's actually writers who sell ideas, is ideas are 10 a penny. Basically, you put together an idea, you stick it out there as a pitch. If it doesn't go, you stick it back in the drawer, you do another idea, and maybe 10 years down the line, the market changes and something becomes available, or you realize that if you take that idea and that idea and put them together. But the whole thing about having, like, that one precious idea that is the thing you're going to do is, anybody who tells me that, I know they're not actually a writer. Because a writer is somebody who comes up with, like, 15 ideas a day.
Hell's bells, don't say that.
but I mean, you know, it's a component of it is idea generation. This is why I can tell a story, and occasionally I can put together, like, a little 5-page comic and people go, oh, that's rather jolly. But I'm not a writer, because I actually had a crack at it. I did, when Andy Deagle was the editor of 2000 AD, I'd actually written and drawn this comic that I kind of self-published, and I sent him a copy, and he went, do me some Future Shocks. And basically, doing enough pictures to generate, I think it was 3 Future Shocks I actually did, used up every idea I've ever had. It just kind of round me out, and it just taught me. It's like, yeah, you know, I can put together something that makes sense, but I'm not a writer because I cannot do that. It is the essential skill that I am lacking.
I did the Future Shocks thing, and it was what I found was that I got one in, but, like, of all the other ones, 2000 AD is already done. That's the one you come up against. Oh yeah, we've done that. When was that? It's like, there's so many stories going through it. So.
I actually got around that by going so bizarre that it's the only time I've ever had feedback from something that was just ... No.
Oh. Okay. Ouch.
Was that David Bishop by any chance?
No, it was Andy Deagle. And you know, it's like, yeah, and he's just saying, no.
I try and pitch stories in 3, so there's one to hate, one for them to go, and one to like. So at least it's kind of. So.
I had a friend over here.
Hi there. I was wondering how technology has changed the collaborative process, and I'm kind of thinking in terms of communication technology. I guess, you know, in the old days, it was quite hard to communicate and send ideas backwards and forwards apart from the telephone. Now you can send each other snippets of scripts and images. Does that go on, and has it changed things for good or bad?
To a certain extent, I mean, what hasn't changed is how busy you are. Which tends to get in the way of that kind of collaborative process. Like, what I always think of is years ago, I interviewed a guy who was a European, like, European comic artist, a guy called Enki Bilal. I don't know if you've heard of him. And he basically, I asked him about his working process, and he sort of said, oh, well, you know, when I'm coming to the end of a project, I ring up my publisher, and the publisher says, oh, let's go out for a cup of coffee and discuss some ideas. And we sit down and we have a cup of coffee and we have some lunch and we discuss a couple of ideas. And the publisher goes, oh, well, I kind of like that one. Try and get me 30 pages in a year and we'll give you this much as an advance. And it's like, if British comics was like that, I would be doing a lot more collaboration with the writers. But as it is, you kind of get the thing, and Ian's already working on, like, two other scripts for other artists, and I'm thinking, oh God, I've got to get through this. And occasionally there'll just be something where it's like, ooh, have I actually got this right? So maybe I'll send him just like cut out a panel and email him a copy of that panel to go, have I got that right or completely wrong? And he'll give me feedback on it. But on the whole, it's just literally time limitation. You do, I mean, in theory, you've got all these things now, like if you think of stuff like Slack, or, you know, I think Google had some sort of service as well. In theory, there's all these collaborative things where you should be able to send documents back and forward to each other all the time. But in practice, it's just the sheer volume of work. You know, by the time I'm working on whatever Scarlet Traces that Ian's written for me, Ian will be doing, you know, Kingmaker for Lee or somebody like that. So it's not a case of the writer being able to sit and kind of oversee everything that's been done. You occasionally sort of ask for feedback. I think where it makes a much bigger difference is just things like being able to include web links and Google image searches for reference. So I mean, certainly, like Ian said, his scripts are kind of just peppered with web links. So he doesn't have to, you know, just go, oh, such and such a character looks roughly like this guy from this TV program, and there are links to three photos of him, and straight away you've just got exactly what he means without having to think about it or get it wrong. The one difference where technology's made a huge difference as an artist is actually acquiring reference pictures in general. Like when we did Ordinary, all of that is set in real world locations in New York. So Rob would just say it's in, you know, such and such a borough, or in some cases it's actually on such and such a street looking in the direction of X thing. And you can go to Google Street View and find that street and look down it and, you know, draw from that and know you're getting exactly the right thing. In fact, there was actually so much reference available for certain things. You're actually not only at the point of going, okay, I found the west entrance to this particular, bus station or something. Can I find a photograph from inside looking out so I can see what's over the road? And that's the point we think, oh, fuck it, I'll just make that up because I would have had to make the whole thing up. And in fact, there's actually a couple of bits that are deliberately wrong in Ordinary. There's a bit where at one point he's getting onto to like a tram car thing and he jumps over a turnstile. And I actually found reference for the turnstile things, and they're like 6 feet high and they're whole body ones. So there's no way you can jump over them. So I actually changed them to London Underground type ones where you could hop over them, because otherwise the story just doesn't work. But it's like they do that in a movie as well. You know, that's usually kind of my sort of standard for that kind of thing. But yeah, the acquisition of reference. And when we did that Low Life with Overdrive, the shark guy. I looked up great white sharks on the internet, and it turns out there are now like sort of danger holidays you can go on where they put you in a shark cage and drop meat in, and sharks come around you, and people photograph these. So there's like 10 billion photos on the internet of sharks going like that. And I realized when you look at enough of them that when you get them from different angles, it's like they've got different expressions. So I literally harvested about 100 shark faces off the internet, categorized them by expression, and then for every panel where the shark guy needed a particular expression, I'd go to the reference thing, pull it out, and trace it off, which is why the shark guy looks so good, because every one of them is taken from a real shark. But the kind of weird side effect of that is that the angle that each of those panels is taken from is determined entirely by what angle the shark head is from. So it's like working backwards from reference in the weirdest way ever, but it just worked really well, so I went with it.
I just think how mad it would have been if Hergé had had the internet.
Yeah. I mean, have you ever seen that thing where, I think it's like the Black Isle, there's certain of the early Tintin books that he redrew. So like there's an early version of the Black Isle where there's a scene with a fire engine, and it's a 1930s fire engine. And then by the time he redrew it, it was like 1958. So he went back and it's got a 1950s fire engine in it instead. It's just bloody hell.
Well, that's a good note to leave it on. That's going to do it for us. I want to thank you all for coming, and I want to thank you all for coming. This is really great. Thank you.
Well, we hope you enjoyed that, Earthlitz. Sorry about any sound issues. This was, of course, being recorded in front of a live audience, so not everybody's microphone technique is perfect, but I hope you at least got the gist of this panel. An absolutely fascinating insight into the behind-the-scenes work that goes on in creating the galaxy's greatest comic. Join us next week for a regular episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast, and make sure you tune in 2 weeks' time for another amazing panel from the 40 years of Thrill Power Festival. Splundig Vertrig.
Dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com. Subscribe digitally on our apps for Apple, Android, and Windows 10. And download DRM free copies from 2000adonline.com. Alert! Alert! Stand by for urgent updates. Search for 2000 AD on Twitter and Facebook. Watch the latest videos at youtube.com/2000ADonline and follow on Instagram at insta2000AD. Program complete. Shutting down.